In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. Joan of Arc has gone down in history as the Virgin Saviour of France, a patriotic martyr who was unjustly burnt at the stake by her enemies. But just how accurate is that version of the story? Speaking to me, Emily Briffitt, for today's Life of the Week episode, Anne Curry charts the extraordinary rise and fall of the young peasant girl whose extraordinary visions and prophecies brought her face to face with King Charles VII and led to her spiritual leadership over the armies of France before leading to her unfortunate demise. So hello, Anne. Thank you so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
It's a pleasure. Good to be here.
So we are going to be delving into the life and legacy of Joan of Arc. So we should probably ask our top internet search query for Joan of Arc is, was she a real person?
It might seem a strange question, but she is. She's such an amazing character. I'm not surprised people ask that question, but she definitely died in 1431.
So we should really contextualise this. Who was Joan of Arc? Can you give us a brief introduction?
We're in the 15th century phase of the Hundred Years' War that began when Henry V invaded in 1415 and won the Battle of Agincourt. Essentially, the English went on doing well, and in 1420, Henry was accepted as heir to the throne of France. Although he died in 1422, his son, Henry VI of England, was officially then King of France. Now, as you can imagine, although some people supported this English claim, and particularly Burgundian allies of the English, there were many people who did not support the idea of an English king. They supported the Dauphin, the legitimate heir, the son of the previous King Charles VI. And amongst those people who supported the Dauphin, the Valois line, was Joan of Arc. She lived in Champagne, in eastern France, in Domrémy, where she was born, and that area had remained pretty loyal to the Valois heir, the Dauphin Charles, later to be Charles VII.
Now, I just want to pick up on something important you mentioned there. I think we often hear of the Hundred Years' War as a battle between England and France, But there were other people involved. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, people often wonder why Henry V had done so well. Well, we could just say he was totally marvellous. But he's helped hugely by the fact there was a civil war in France in the early 15th century between the Orleanist group, or sometimes called the Armagnacs, who were essentially related to the brother of Charles VI, and the Burgundians. The Dukes of Burgundy were a collateral line of the French royal family, and they were daggers drawn. It had started when the Duke of Burgundy had the Duke of Orleans assassinated in the early 1400s, and it went on, and it blew up again in September 1419, when the Dauphin Charles, he was involved in the assassination of John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. And it's often said that it was through the hole in John the Fearless's head that the English entered France. Immediately after that murder in September 1419, the Burgundians, Duke Philip, rushed to ally with the English. And essentially then he wants vengeance for the murder of his father. And so he allies with Henry V. And it's really through that that the Treaty of Troyes comes about and Henry is recognised as the future King of France. And as you can imagine, the Dauphin, Charles, has to flee because he's guilty, potentially, of being involved in a murder. And there are various court cases against him. He's declared an outlaw and he's disinherited. And so it's a pretty bad situation for him. But inevitably, he's still alive. He fled south of the River Loire. He's based in nice places like Chinon and Tours and Poitiers. And you can imagine that there were plenty of people, particularly south of the Loire, but a number north of the Loire as well, who really believed he should be King of France and not Henry VI. And that's the situation we're in 1429, when Joan of Arc pops up on the historical stage for the first time.
Now, to bring us back to Joan, could you tell us a little bit about her early life, her childhood, her background before she really takes centre stage?
Like many girls of the Middle Ages, and indeed many people of poorer status, we actually know very little about Joan. We don't even know when she was born, but we think it's likely it was 1412. So she's a teenager when all of these things are happening in 1429 onwards, and that's quite important. She was born in the village of Domremy, which was in the Duchy of Bar. It's on the eastern frontier of France, and it can be visited today. In fact, her house is still there. It may not be exactly the same house, but there is the core of the house in which she was born, let's say in 1412. It's also fair to say that as time went on, she became very famous. She's canonised in 1920, but lots of stories about her developed, and she was given a special birthday. It was said that her birthday was the 6th of January, Epiphany. There isn't any proof of that, so we don't know the day on which she was born.
What sources do we actually have to tell us about Joan's life?
We have essentially trial records. Joan was tried twice. Once when she was alive in 1431, that's a trial in Rouen. That's often called the process of condemnation because she's found guilty of heresy at the end of it. And then in 1455-6, we have the trial of nullity, the rehabilitation, if you like, that overturned that judgment of the ecclesiastical court. Now, both of those trials are amazing. The first one's amazing because she speaks herself. She's asked lots of questions. And so actually she tells us quite a bit about her childhood and her friends and that sort of thing. But more significant in giving all this circumstantial detail is the trial of rehabilitation, because they interviewed over 100 people for it, including people she'd been friendly with. In fact, her mother's still alive in 1455 as well. So her childhood friends, somebody she babysat for. So that's how we know so much about Joan. She doesn't feature all that much in the historical sources, the chronicles, things. She's not in the bureaucratic government records of the area, because as a girl, as a woman, she's not really that significant. But her father does, and that's interesting because they're farmers essentially in this place. He has animals and she looks after some of the animals, possibly goes to the plough, that kind of thing. but he's also called doyen of the village. He's kind of a local foreman, if you like, shop steward, you know, of the village. So he pops up there. We know a bit about him. We know she had priests in the family. We think that probably her mother was of slightly higher social status than her father, that kind of thing. So it has been possible to reconstruct a lot about Joan herself. But what we mainly know about her then comes from her own testimony and from the testimony of those she was associated with in what we call her mission, which is very short. It's only from 1429 to 1430.
With all these medieval sources, how close can we actually get to the real Joan of Arc?
The sources for Joan raise some problems. The most obvious is if you're tried for heresy, is trial testimony like that accurate? If you're asked questions, you're scared, you've got all these theologians against you, is it really going to bring out the best in you? Are you going to answer truthfully? But there's also a problem with the trial of rehabilitation, because by then people wanted to rehabilitate her. So are they going to say she was very pious, more pious than anybody else, because they knew by then she'd been burnt at the stake? So these are loaded judgments, really, about her. Nonetheless, because of those two trials, we know more about Joan than of any comparable girl of lower status, I think probably across the whole of the Middle Ages.
That's incredible when you think about it. Speaking about Joan's spirituality, she's famous for having had vivid visions. When did these start and what were they about?
She would have been brought up like all children in the village. Her mother taught her her basic prayers. She'd have gone to church. And it seems around the age of 12, I mean, this is something she herself implies, she began to have visions. And initially in her own trial, she wasn't very keen to speak of these visions, but she got more confident and she started to explain a little bit more about what they were. So angels appeared to her, then St. Catherine and St. Margaret appeared, and then St. Michael the Archangel appeared. And they seem to have said to her, or she's interpreting it in this way, that she essentially had a mission to save France, essentially to boot out the English and to put the Dauphin on the throne as Charles VII. So what we've got then is this interesting mixture of religiosity. She believes she's sent by God. God has chosen her to do this, but her mission is entirely political, to restore the rightful King of France.
How do you link those two things, the religiosity and the political aspects of that mission? Is that a kind of common thread we see in the Middle Ages?
It is a common thread, and I don't think they could divide these things into political and religious as we do nowadays. Remember that it was God who made kings, and indeed in the trial of condemnation she was asked questions about did she see angels bringing a crown for Charles and things, but they were trying to trick her into both treasonable statements but also heretical statements. But she really believed that God wanted a Valois King of France, and she lives in an area that was what we might call very patriotic. She wasn't in those parts of France like Normandy and even Paris that were quite happy with an English king because they were pro-Burgundian, but she is in what we might call then a patriotic, a freedom fighting area for the Valois line.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
How much of what we know about her spirituality is typical of what was deemed of perhaps female spirituality, or in a similar way, what was deemed saintly and maybe attributed backwards in time?
I think there's several important things that mark her out. At the trial of rehabilitation, her friends were very keen to say that she liked religion. She'd really got into religion, to use modern expressions at that. She herself implied she wasn't into teenage things like dancing around a tree where you've got a boyfriend. She was quite serious-minded about this. She couldn't have become a nun because that wasn't suitable for women of her status. So what we've got is a very private conviction of religious inspiration there. And I think that that colours her entire behaviour. So, for instance, her virginity, and that is very much part of this. She has to be the virgin who is going to save France. So she refuses to marry. Her father tries to get her married off, which would have been her normal lot in life, and she refuses that. So her virginity is absolutely key to this mission. And I think also she is very much into saying, you know, God punishes the sins of men, but I know that the English will be punished, if you like, and that you have the rightful cause and all of that. Now, this, of course, theologically is very difficult because she is someone who claims to know the mind of God. So almost everything she says is going to be heretical because she is not a priest. She's a woman. All those limitations placed on women in this period in that context. Nonetheless, of course, she's not the only holy woman around. There was quite a spate of female saints like St. Bridget, for Sweden. So it is a period where you have these prophetesses, and indeed she comes across another during her mission called Catherine, who she's actually quite rude about. Joan clearly thinks she knows what God wants, and this other woman should go back to our family. She's not really a proper prophetess. So Joan is unique, I think, amongst the social level that we're talking about. But I think I would emphasise the teenage religiosity. She's got into religion in a big way, connected to a political outcome.
With such conviction, how was Joan able to meet and contend with the Dauphin and the French nobility?
It is quite incredible how she got to meet the Dauphin, because that's the crucial thing. If she's the virgin to save France, she needs to have the wherewithal to do it. Essentially, she seems to have persuaded Robert de Baudricourt, who is one of the local captains before him. Quite a lot happens in those first months. She pops up in February 1429. She may even have gone to visit the Duke of Lorraine, for instance, at one point, but we don't quite know what happened. But she does persuade, and she is helped to dress as a man, as a page, and to go off with a group of other people from Domrémy all the way down to Chinon to meet the king. Now, this could be because the French were in a pretty desperate situation. They were not doing well at all, and had the English succeeded in taking Orleans, it would have made it possible to cross the Loire and to enter into the kingdom of Bourges, as it's called, where the Dauphin was holding sway. So this is a very important turning point militarily. She is able to go. It may be people knew that Charles needed help. Maybe they also knew that Charles himself was quite into this sort of thing, i.e. he was into mystical solutions for things. But there's a further point, and that is these courts, like the court of the Dauphin, were very political in their own right, and there was a lobby in it called the Angevin group, and they are linked to René of Anjou, who was an heir to this Duchy of Bar. And it's possible that that group thought, oh, we'll get influence with Charles through this girl, and therefore they may have assisted her to go. But it seems as though she popped up in the first place and said what she wanted to do, and then that was facilitated. So off she goes to Chinon, and she does meet with the Dauphin, and she convinces him as well. Now, of course, it isn't quite so straightforward, because anybody in their right mind would be saying, who is this girl who's turned up? She has to be checked out. And first of all, they have to check she is a virgin. That's the sort of requirement number one. If you're the virgin to save France, you've got to make sure she's a virgin. So she was checked over by ladies at the court. In fact, she was to be later on by the English as well. And then she is discussed, she's questioned by theologians in Poitiers, and we have some indication of what she was asked, although there is some thought that their conclusions were suppressed a bit, that the king had been so taken by her and he wanted her to be there as a sort of figurehead and the spiritual inspiration of his army, that things were covered up really a bit in that. But she is allowed to go. It seems as though there's some basic military training given to her in the court there, and maybe some armour purchased for her. And then they get ready. Charles is raising quite a big army as well. They get ready to march towards Orléans to raise the siege there. That's essentially what is happening. And she gets into Orléans. That's really where the action starts, if you like.
Now, that is really one of the famous moments in Joan's life. Could you tell us a little bit about the Siege of Orléans and what was Joan's role in it?
The Siege of Orléans had been laid by the English in the autumn of 1428. It was meant to be the big push. And a big army had come from England, and they'd raised soldiers from all the garrisons in Normandy, and there they were sitting around Orleans. Now, it was going on for quite a long time. Joan popped up in February. The siege has already been going on for about 4 months by then. In fact, there was a real need to bring more food in, and so there's a little battle called the Battle of the Herrings, where the English managed to bring in the foodstuffs. So it might look at one level as though the French are very unlikely to be able to hold on to Orleans. However, the longer sieges go on, the more difficult they get for the besiegers. And so it wasn't that easy for the English to invest a big city like that. In fact, one thing that I've always found interesting is it wasn't difficult at all for Joan to get into Orleans. Well, it's not much of a siege if you can cross the river from the south and get into the city and encourage the citizens to resist. And then she attacks outwards towards the English on the bridge. So it's not much of a siege. But you can imagine that the miracle of the wind that took her in the boat down the river and into the city of Orleans, is actually one of the things used to show there was a miracle, if you like, in her getting there. She goes in with a small group of people. Obviously, she's welcomed there. And then the bigger French army is following on behind her. So you could say, by the time all this is happening, it's pretty likely that the French are going to be able to raise the siege. And I've often wondered, would Charles have sent her in there if he thought it was going to fail? Because God wouldn't have been shown to have been on the French side, would it, then? So does he know already, his advisers and military men, do they know already they've got a pretty good chance? And therefore, having this extra element of God and his handmaiden, if you like, is that really going to get him off to a very, very good start in this attempt to defeat the English?
Joan of Arc is almost depicted as this saviour of France. How responsible was she herself for the turnaround in French fortunes?
I think she is the saviour because Charles needs something different, something new, some reason for people to believe in him. And she essentially is that reason. She herself has said to him, she will deliver a sign of God's approval, essentially, a sign that she is sent from God. And the sign, of course, is the raising of the siege of Orleans. And it happens. In fact, the English are driven out very easily. Joan and her supporters come across the bridge, and there's a pretty serious sort of fight there. The English fall in the river and are killed, and they run away, and the siege is raised. Obviously, by then, Charles is coming with a much larger army, but you could say she is the catalyst. I think that is the word I would use for this situation. I should say also that after this, the French go on from strength to strength. They recover many of the other places that the English have taken along the Loire, and they also fight a battle against the English at Patay, and they take a lot of prisoners, and they're then able to start their advance towards the city of Reims, which is where Charles needs to go in order to be crowned legitimate King of France.
In that way, how far was Joan used as almost propaganda by the French leadership?
I guess that's always going to be the question. Is she set up? Well, yes, but remember, they have priests as well. They're all confessing their sins. They're having lots of religious ceremonies. She's part of that. She's part of that religious dimension to warfare, because that was a central part of warfare. And I don't think, again, that the people of the time would have distinguished those things in that way. We also know that, for instance, when things are going badly, Joan goes off to pray. And this is noted in the reminiscences of people in her trial of rehabilitation. And after that, everything goes all right. So it's as if Joan prays to God to help, you know, what should we do next? And so it all works out right. As a military historian myself, I think the English are not in a stronger position. You know, there are other reasons, but nonetheless, we need inspiration. It's like a sporting team. We need the skill, but we need the inspiration and the dedication as well. And Joan really helps to provide that. And once she's successful, once she's seen to be successful, then everything seems to go the right way for her and for the French. So I think that that is interesting. Whether she's really a military leader, of course, is dubious. She hasn't got an official role in the whole thing, but nonetheless, she is seen as someone who has a direct line to God and therefore is worth listening to.
France at this time was linguistically and culturally diverse. How was Joan able to unite and inspire?
Joan is able to unite and inspire by a sort of collective religion, but also by the idea of the monarch of the whole of France. France is a very diverse country, but it had one king. Now, of course, at this time it has two, but that's because of English invasion. But the French were very loyal to their king. So what was necessary was for the king to be crowned at Reims and to be anointed with the holy oil. So she needed to get Charles, and he needed to get himself to Reims. And that's essentially what happened. We have some really interesting sources for this, because Joan wrote letters. She wrote letters to the English, sent out at Easter, and the idea there, she's summoning them to surrender because God has told them to. And then we have letters to various towns asking them to surrender or telling them to surrender. So we have such a letter for Troyes and I think for Reims as well. So it's a sort of orchestrated campaign in order to get the king to Reims. And she's present at the coronation in Reims as well in the middle of July in 1429. So this is a very, very successful period in the revival of Valois fortunes in France.
Now, there were prophecies surrounding Joan. Can you tell us a little bit about these?
Yes, the French, remember, were in a very, very desperate state, and I think people clung on to anything. There were some prophecies of France being saved by a virgin. Of course, the traditional interpretation would be the Virgin Mary that would do that. There were also prophecies that a girl would ride down on the back of English archers, all these sorts of things. In fact, even Merlin gets cited in some of these. But I think these are important for the mindset of the time. Maybe the French sort of clung on to these sorts of legends, if you like, in the hope that they would meet with some success. And Charles was a very superstitious king, and therefore it's the kind of thing that appealed to him. So there was a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you like. And of course it does come off. Charles is able to get crowned with the oil of Clovis and to become a legitimate French king, which the English haven't been able to do. The English then have to think about rushing to crown their king, Henry VI, in England. So they crowned him in November 1429, and then to bring him to France. And they do that in April 1430 with an idea of taking him to Reims and getting him crowned king, because it's not so easy now, because the French hold Reims. So that's going to be a very, very difficult military manoeuvre. So that's where we are, if you like, in the autumn, if you like, of 1429 and into 1430.
We're speaking a little bit about the optics here. Now, I was wondering, Joan's got a quite famous look. Could you tell us a little bit about what she looked like and what we know about how she presented herself?
Yeah, we don't know what Joan looked like, but there was a little doodle in the margins of the records of the Parlement of Paris. And there she is holding a banner with IHS on it. And Joan says, you know, my banner is much more important to me than my sword is. So that's how people saw her carrying the banner. And so she wanted to portray herself with the banner with Jesus Maria on it. That's a very interesting picture too, because it doesn't really sort of suggest she's wearing armour, yet we know that she did. She's a sort of warrior sent by God, if you like, to liberate the French. And she looks as though she's wearing a pleated skirt. Maybe that was an effort to sort of show the lanes of armour, the skirt-like effect of armour. We have no other contemporary images of her, and there's no guarantee that was drawn by someone who'd seen her. So we don't know what she looked like. All of the images, we start getting manuscripts in the later 15th century, sort of draw her again. There's a very famous manuscript connected. It's called the Vigile de Charles VII, the Vigils of Charles VII. It's a sort of history of it. And she's shown there, again, she's wearing a skirt, but a breastplate and a helmet as well. So what exactly she was dressed in is, I think, an interesting point. But we do know she's wearing men's clothes on many occasions, and going to see that when she finally confesses and she's imprisoned, she's given women's clothes to wear, which we think she does wear there. But we've got to assume she is wearing men's clothes most of the time.
I think this raises a really interesting point surrounding gender and how this was seen in the medieval period. Can we say that Joan transcended medieval gender roles, or did she perhaps utilise them?
Yeah, I mean, there is an irony here. It's the woman who saves France, but it's a woman dressed as a man and behaving like a man who saves France. So she behaves like a man. Women in this period were meant to be the gentle sex, and they were not meant to involve themselves in military activity in this way. So noble women might send troops, they might be involved in negotiations, and they might be involved in defending with the aid of their households if their castles attacked, but they're not warriors in their own right. So Joan is usurping a male role there. It's quite interesting to see sometimes knights are accused of being effeminatus, effeminate, and that means, you know, like a woman, fearful, and so therefore not suitable, if you like, to behave as true knights. So Joan is, yes, I suppose you could say she's taking on male characteristics. So it's quite interesting that we know, for instance, she's commented on that she cried and she showed her softer side quite often as well. So I don't think we can say that Joan pretended to be a man. I think throughout all of this, it is obvious she's a woman. It's obvious to the English as well as it is to the French. She's a woman dressed in men's clothes.
So if we continue on with the story a little bit, what was Joan's role during the subsequent campaigns?
I think we can argue that once Charles had been crowned king, there wasn't really any need for a virgin to save France, because they had a king to save France. Now, a legitimate king in continuity with all the kings of the past, having had the oil of Clovis on his anointing and then his crowning. So what is Joan to do? Well, she is so committed to this revival of Valois fortunes, she wants to get Paris. And so she's trying to persuade Charles all the time to go on and launch an attack on Paris. That would be a pretty difficult thing to do, partly because Paris was very loyal to the Burgundians and hence to the English. It's not just the defence of Paris, it's a very large city at this point, but also the intellectual heart, if you like, of the Anglo-Burgundian monarchy, the dual monarchy. Anyway, they do attempt this, although I think Charles is pretty lukewarm about it, and it goes disastrously wrong. This is into September of 1429, and I think it really undermines Joan's position. People stop believing in her. She becomes vulnerable from that point onwards. Charles decides he's not going to try again. He retreats. And it gets even more difficult as to what Joan should do. There's some little campaigns she gets involved in, almost as a sort of freebooting captain, until the spring of 1430, where it is decided that the French need to recover the area around Compiègne. And so Joan goes off to Compiègne to help the defenders there. During sieges, it was quite common for sorties to be conducted. She leads a sortie out of the town and she's captured. There are some rumours that the gates were closed against her by her own side, so she couldn't get back in again. And we also know that there are some, even of Charles's supporters, who are not sure about her anymore. You're starting to get letters written. Even the Bishop of Chartres, for instance, is coming out with, well, she wasn't listening to God. You know, she was behaving in her own volition rather than actually being a good daughter of the church. So things are starting to turn against her, and her capture may well be, and we weren't too sure, may well be an example of that. But she's captured by the Burgundians, essentially, moved around quite a bit. The Duke of Burgundy comes to see her on, I think, two occasions, and they really have no choice but to hand her over to the English, because the English, well, I want to say the English, to the King of France, Henry VI, and his administrators. And so after lots of negotiations, after the raising of a tax in Normandy to pay the ransom, essentially, she is brought down to Rouen, and she arrives in Rouen just before Christmas, 1430. So it's quite an interesting period, that, because she is visited by women, say the Duchess of Burgundy and that kind of thing. So we know quite a lot of bit about that period of imprisonment. Developed a legend later on that she tried to commit suicide during that period. She didn't want to be captured. And also there was quite a debate as to whether she was a prisoner of war or not. In this period, prisoners of war had rights. They weren't to be killed. They were to be ransomed. And so was Joan a prisoner of war. Yet in the laws of war, such as they were in this time, there was a feeling that women couldn't be taken prisoner. So therefore, what was she? But in the midst of all of this, the religious dimension is very important. There was a desire to investigate her for her religious views, if you like, to try her for heresy. So I think we've got to bear in mind two things. One is that the things that Joan had done were contrary to the teachings of the church at the time, so she was bound to be investigated for that. But the second thing is that she was a traitor. She was a traitor to the legitimate King of France, Henry VI. So whatever the case, Joan was in trouble. She was going to be tried for something or other.
During Joan's trial, obviously you've mentioned about heresy and treason. Were there any other crimes that she was accused of? And were all of these genuine or fair to accuse her of?
Yeah, as you can imagine, there's been a great debate as to whether the trial of Joan was fair or not. It was conducted like all heresy trials. There were lots of different stages to it. And one of them was getting evidence about her youth, about her life and all of that kind of thing. That was a bit tricky because the French, the Valois, controlled those areas. Also, there was the question as to where the trial should be conducted and who should conduct it. And there has been a suggestion that her capture was just inside the bishopric of Beauvais. You know, they may have deliberately taken her 50 yards down the road to capture her there, so that Pierre Couchon was the investigating bishop. But of course, the trial is held in Rouen because that was the most secure place to hold her and to conduct the trial. The trial had entirely French investigators and judges. It's often said the English controlled the trial. They did, but as kings of France. So it's an Anglo-Burgundian regime, if you like, at this point. So all of the judges of Joan are French there, and the trial is conducted as far as possible according to the traditions and stages of trials. There's some early questioning of Joan, but essentially there's about a month of investigating and all of this kind of thing, and then the trial proper opens towards the end of March 1431. And it goes through the standard stages with charges put to Joan, eventually a summary of those charges and questions asked. Of course, this is where it gets really fascinating because we have Joan's voice.
And what can we tell about Joan's experience through this voice?
I think we see stages in her own mental state there. Remember, she's in solitary confinement a lot of the time. She's guarded by English soldiers. I think they were very careful to treat her as well as they would any other prisoner, at least at this stage of the investigation. It's quite an amusing thing that she sent some carp to eat, and supposedly she becomes unwell, and everybody says, oh, you know, they're trying to poison her. No, there was the good cop, bad cop approach in these heresy trials, and so they were trying to persuade her, you know, to accept God's will and to confess and all of that. She's threatened with torture. I don't think she is actually tortured, but these are all parts of the stages of trials. But what does she herself say? Well, initially, she's not that keen to say anything at all, and she tends to say pass. Oh, I'm not going to answer that question. But she gets more confident and she starts to say more. She's quite open about her early life, about her family, and also she starts to say more about the saints that she's seen. Initially she doesn't name them, then she does come to name them. She comes out with things that were likely to indict her, to be honest. It's not that she confesses, it's she says things like the saints, you know, they had bodies and all of that, which of course were not in line with the church's teaching. And I think the main thing we get out of this trial, and this has been very nicely done by Karen Sullivan, is the idea that you've got this girl, okay, pious and all of that, faced with the greatest intellects, if you like, of churchmen of the time. You know, there's a sort of imbalance. Joan is faced with this huge intellectual armoury, if you like, of the Anglo-Burgundian church in France at this time.
What was the outcome of this trial for Joan?
I think one of the problems for Joan was that she also became a little bit cheeky in the trial. And remember, she's immensely patriotic. So she wants Charles to be king, and she never swerves from that. She is guilty within the context of contemporary beliefs about knowing the mind of God. She knew what was going to happen. She could predict the future. All those were indictable offences within customary beliefs of the time. And on the 24th of May, she recants, essentially. She says, yes, you know, I am guilty as charged. And she recants of that heresy. And that's often forgotten, that Joan does confess her own sins. She does it publicly, and she is then imprisoned. We know that she's then in women's clothing at that point in time. So you could say, that's it, it's over. And I'm sure that that would have pleased the regime. So, but she then reneges on that recantation within 4 days. She puts the men's clothes back on again, as far as we can see, and she's visited and she reneges on basically what she'd said 4 days before. Now, this is the really difficult thing about Joan of Arc. There are many historians who said she was pressured into it by the English, i.e. that they took our women's clothes away and they left the men's ones out, because one of the things that she shouldn't have been doing was wearing men's clothes. It was seen as a usurpation of the right order of God's universe. So that is one thing that they tricked her into it. They threatened her with rape, things of this sort. But I think we are doing Joan an injustice by saying she was misled by her jailers. I think someone who'd been so committed to the Valois cause and so pious herself and really considerable belief in God, why not allow her to have changed her mind and to have realised that all she'd fought for, all she'd believed, you know, and she probably felt herself that she'd done the wrong thing in confessing. So there's a hasty retrial. And she is condemned, but the church cannot kill people. That would be a bit illogical. So she's handed over to the secular arm for punishment. And that, again, was a standard arrangement.
Now, for listeners who are familiar with Joan's story, they'll be aware of the way in which Joan died. Could you tell us a little bit about this and the significance of it?
Yes, it's a public execution. It's a burning. So she's fastened to the stake, if you like, and a fire is put around her. Now, this is not unique to her. It happened to other people. It's linked, you know, to the sort of purging of the soul and all that kind of thing. But there is another element for women. It's interesting that it's a way of no person kills her, if you think about it. It's the smoke and the flames that kill her. So there's a sort of respect for women, ironically, in some of this as well. There was also the idea of the destruction of the body of the heretic. And also they were trying to avoid any idea of sort of relics and things of this sort, and therefore the body is disposed of, probably thrown in the river. One of the chronicles of the time, the chronicle known as the Bourgeois of Paris, or these little clergymen, says that after the fire had died down, it's raked back, her body is shown to show that she was a woman. So implying there were some people around who thought she was a man. But there was another reason for that, and that was also, it was believed that the hearts of virgins didn't burn, and therefore it was a humiliation for her. And that. So I think we can say that executions of this sort were intended for the crowd. You know, it was intended as a some public thing that would show them this was an evil act she had committed and don't you do it. You know, it has that kind of element to it as well.
Now, many years after Joan's death, her name was cleared. Why and how exactly does this happen?
It wasn't possible to do anything until the English had been booted out of Normandy, which happens in 1449 to 50. And after that, we see an interest in a trial of nullity, like a rehabilitation trial. Her mother is still alive and she's keen for this. Charles VII is persuaded, because it's all tied up with national identity, really, and with his legitimacy as King of France. And so this is carried out absolutely to the letter. So I think we have something like 115 or so witnesses. And with all of this evidence, this is absolutely amazing. Again, it's how we know so much about Joan. Whatever you want to know about Joan, we hear about it. We hear, for instance, from the Duke of Alençon, who sort of fought alongside her, about how good she was at the quintain, and she rode a horse well. You know, that's amazing. Oh, she knew where to put the guns. Quite amazing things about her in this. And at the end of the day, the trial is found to have been improper, and that in her is found no sign of impiety or all this kind of thing. It didn't actually say she wasn't a heretic. It's one that the church had to operate within the constraints of the time. And it is quite important here that Joan, when she was eventually canonised in 1920, Joan is not one of the martyrs, she's actually a virgin. So the church always had a slight difficulty, because it had been the church that had condemned her to death, the church in that same country.
So what circumstances led to her becoming a saint?
Joan is famous immediately after her death. And already in Orleans, there were ceremonies annually. A play was written about her within the 15th century. And all the way through, you get an interest in her. But it starts to heat up, and there is a local cult. And it's quite interesting in Domrémy that when the French Revolution suppresses these sorts of things, Napoleon thought it right that it should be allowed to continue. So Joan isn't a saint, but she has a local following. There isn't much of a sense of her as a national saint at this time. It's in the later 19th century, and in the mid-19th century, we see a huge interest in France in history. There's a lot of patriotic works written, all the more so after the Franco-Prussian War, because the French are very humiliated by that. The area she came from, Lorraine, that was a contested area. It always remained in France, her bit, but Alsace-Lorraine, parts of it, passed to the Germans after 1870. So it's all tied up with that. It's tied up too with politics in France. She's very much the heroine of the right wing in the late 19th, early 20th century. So eventually the case is accepted by the investigators, you know, the way saints are made, by the Vatican, and she is declared blessed, I think, in 1909. There's a big public ceremony. Now, normally speaking, it wouldn't take long to go from blessed to being an actual saint, but it took longer because of the First World War, and therefore she's not canonised until 1920. But there are war memorials for the First World War for the French that have Joan of Arc on them. And even in England, there's a church built in Farnham, a Catholic church, which is dedicated to her. And in St. Jude Church in Hampstead, a garden suburb, There she is on the dome in a First World War memorial chapel, along with Queen Alexandra, Elizabeth Fry, and quite a number of suffragettes. So she's beginning to become a heroine of women. Women, really, in the world of men. She was a real heroine of the suffragettes. That's fascinating that they often had a woman dressed as Joan on a horse in their processions. And when the vote was finally given, initially to women over 30, the front of their magazine had Joan standing there in medieval gear with a banner, not with Jesus Maria on it, but with At Last on it. So she became a symbol of women, really, and what women could do in society.
I think this really strongly links on to what you've just been speaking about. Firstly, of all the figures in French history, why is Joan's life seized upon as the symbol of national pride? But also, as another part of that, why has Joan attained such a mythic stature in popular imagination more widely?
I think we've got to consider that Joan is perhaps more popular in some parts of France than others. I think you could almost draw a line across the middle of France, south of which she's not as well known. But in the north, I think she is, because she's connected with important locations like Lorraine, Champagne, Reims, the coronation, Paris, Rouen, Chinon, where she met the king. So the north of France is very much her territory. She's part of a tourist experience, but also part of a pride in French national identity there as well. She was even used by the Vichy regime, of course. The Vichy regime produced a very famous poster, and it showed her tied to the stake, and it was about Allied bombing of Rouen, of Normandy, and it said the enemy always returned to the scene of their crimes. So she is known. She's part of the Catholic education in France as well, and she's become also even a heroine of the left. Ségolène Royal featured her in a book she wrote, because she's seen as a spirited woman, if you like, a woman of lower class who actually plays a very important role in politics, somebody wholly committed to patriotism. So she's important in that respect. But the point about Joan is she's a heroine for everyone. I've been doing work recently on her as a heroine for the English, because the great writers like Southey, Charles Dickens, Walter Scott, Jane Austen, Rita Sackville-West, they all wrote about her in a very praiseworthy manner, because she's feisty. She's secular, according to Southey. She was a child of nature who had a direct line to God. She didn't bother about that pompous church or the pompous nobility. She was her own woman. So there's been a lot of interest in her as a woman. I think also she's very attractive, isn't she? I mean, because of her feistiness. And so the very famous play by Bernard Shaw, which follows her canonisation, even though it's a British play, is very much the feisty woman. I think T.S. Eliot said that he'd made Joan a kind of Mrs. Pankhurst figure. It's sort of ahistorical there. So there's that. There's a feminist thing. There's even the potentially the gay Joan. There was something said at her trial of rehabilitation that she didn't like to sleep with old women, but she was quite happy sleeping with younger girls, that sort of stuff. It's probably totally misinterpreted, really. Then you're going to get into films. There's been many, many films of her of all different kinds. All actresses wanted to play her. But you can see why this feisty teenager, who's very special and, you know, amazing, is going to fit with whatever scenario you want to put her into.
From that, what would you say are perhaps your personal favourite retellings or uses or interpretations of Joan and her story?
For me, the most interesting ones are the suffragettes. I think it is how you can take someone who wasn't a feminist. You know, feminism didn't exist in the 15th century, but it's using that as the image of the woman who can succeed in the world of men, who can defeat men at their own game, who can get the vote. And it's also interesting because the suffragettes became quite violent. Now, Joan herself was pretty violent. Even though she says she loved her banner more than her sword, she says she never killed anyone. She is involved in a wartime situation. So you could say maybe that was was an attractive thing for the suffragettes. But I think the most attractive thing is the visual. She was able to be portrayed on a horse. They always made it very obvious she was a woman, incidentally, and leading processions. But also that she did succeed. Charles became king and she herself is exonerated and made a saint. So the suffragettes were investing, if you like, in someone who fitted what they wanted to put across, but also who did gain eventual success. So it was a good symbol to use. So I think what I like there is the sort of use of history, if you like, use of a character from history in that kind of way.
That was Anne Curry, Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at the University of Southampton, an expert in the Hundred Years' War, especially the Battle of Agincourt, English armies and Joan of Arc.